Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
In recent months, Pakistan has been slipping deeper into crisis. Emergency rule, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, militancy creeping from the tribal areas into the heart of the country. But Pakistan is not just any country. It's a nuclear-armed state whose instability causes deep anxiety around the world and especially in Washington. Bruce Riddell was a top analyst at the CIA for nearly three decades.
Pakistan is perhaps the most dangerous country in the world today. All of the nightmares of the 21st century come together. Nuclear war, nuclear proliferation, Al-Qaeda, terrorism, jihadism, democracy, dictatorship, drug smuggling, all of them are mixed together in Pakistan.
And in Washington, headline writers, think tank pundits and politicians are starting to ponder what to do should the worst happen. The United States simply could not stand by as a nuclear-armed Pakistan descended into the abyss, reads a recent much-discussed opinion article in the New York Times. We need to think now about our feasible military options, it concluded. And even in the American presidential campaign, the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons is up for debate.
So far as we know right now, the nuclear technology is considered secure. But there isn't any guarantee, especially given the political turmoil going on inside Pakistan. I would work very hard to try to get Musharraf to share the security responsibility of the nuclear weapons with a delegation from the United States and perhaps Great Britain so that there is some fail-safe.
This is a very naive idea, and coming from a person who is supposed to be very well experienced in the governmental affairs and a Washington insider.
Retired Brigadier General Naeem Salik, a former Director of Arms Control and Disarmament Affairs, worked at the heart of Pakistan's nuclear establishment.
I think that appeared to be a very immature kind of a comment, and I am sure that once she gets into the White House and she's properly briefed, she won't make such a statement again.
And in London last week, I asked President Musharraf for his response.
Hillary Clinton talked about the idea of sharing security for Pakistan's arsenal. What's your reaction to that kind of talk?
Very negative. Please understand that this is our sensitivity. I would be foolish as the president of Pakistan if I accepted any kind of foreign people coming in and intruding into our nuclear. We guard it very jealously. And it is in the minds and hearts of every individual Pakistani, even in the most illiterate man.
This programme for the BBC World Service will be looking at whether the world really should be worried about the safety of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Is there a real threat, or is it simply a case of media hype and scaremongering? For Naeem Salik, who was deeply involved in the security of Pakistan's weapons, it's a story of innate distrust rather than real danger.
It appears that people are very reluctant still to accept Pakistan as a nuclear power. And a lot of people in Pakistan think that this is because Pakistan happens to be an Islamic country and it's very difficult and unpalatable for the West to accept a Muslim country with nuclear weapons. So that's generally the feeling here in Pakistan.
But it's the history of Pakistan's nuclear program that has created much of the concern. Pakistan's quest for the bomb began in the 1970s, born out of a fear of India and its nuclear program. The bomb represented survival. The program remained clandestine until India tested in 1998, leading to Pakistan following a few days later. The following year, the two countries nearly came to war. A nuclear exchange was close, but who had their finger on the nuclear button in Islamabad? Senior CIA analyst Bruce Riddell was present when Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif came to the White House.
President Clinton found himself with the Prime Minister on his doorstep on the 4th of July, 1999. The Prime Minister had called urgently 2 days before, saying that he desperately needed to see the President in order to resolve the conflict over Kargil, where Indian and Pakistani regular military forces were engaged in a mini-war. When we went to the meeting, we had very disturbing indications from our intelligence community that Pakistan's nuclear arsenal was being alerted for possible use. The president chose to share that information with Prime Minister Sharif in order to make sure that he understood, as well as the president did, what the stakes were. And it was very clear that Prime Minister Sharif had only an indirect knowledge of what was going on in his own nuclear weapons force, and only an indirect knowledge of much of what the army was up to.
America's concerns used to focus on who had their finger on the trigger in Islamabad. But soon events would collide in a way that made Washington worry about a different threat.
At least 150 to 200 feet wide. Oh, my God!
Oh,
the next building
is
another one. Oh, my God!
In the aftermath of 9/11, the US became fixated on the idea of terrorists getting their hands on nuclear weapons. And just a few weeks after the attack, intelligence arrived that set off alarm bells all over Washington. Mark Fitzpatrick was working on nuclear proliferation at the State Department at the time.
Right after September 11th, it was discovered that Pakistani retired nuclear scientists had been talking with the al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden himself was asking about how to construct a nuclear weapon, and these scientists were drawing simple diagrams and making simple explanations, and they themselves did not have the knowledge base to be able to give al-Qaeda the technology to build a bomb. But the fact that they were talking with al-Qaeda came as a shock.
They were not really people who were working in the sensitive areas of the nuclear program.
Retired Brigadier General Naeem Salik.
They were not the weapon designers. They had nothing to do with the weapons themselves, though they were nuclear engineers, and they shouldn't have been allowed free hand to move around and talk to people. But the investigations proved without any doubt that they never passed on any sensitive information to people who they contacted with in Afghanistan.
But there was another, arguably much more troubling story emerging that raised questions about the controls on Pakistan's program.
My entire lifetime achievement of providing foolproof national security to my nation could have been placed in serious jeopardy on account of...
In 2004, AQ Khan, the man known in Pakistan as the father of the bomb, made a shocking confession.
...related to unauthorized proliferation activities.
He revealed that he'd sold nuclear secrets, including even the design for a nuclear bomb, to a virtual gallery of rogue states in the eyes of Washington, including Iran, Libya and North Korea. President Musharraf was on the defensive.
We need to correct our house. We are a responsible nation. We must not proliferate.
But was this simply a story of Khan's own private greed, as Musharraf maintained, or was the state complicit in his work? State complicity would have dire implications. Mark Fitzpatrick.
If it was the state that itself had given the orders to AQ Khan to sell the technology, then no level of command and control that's put in place would prevent it from happening again, because if the state made a decision again to sell it, then all the controls are irrelevant.
Naeem Salik says the AQ Khan story is a closed chapter.
After that, there has not been any such incident, not even an attempt to do that. Unfortunately, the AQ Khan affair has occupied so much of space in the media and in the public perceptions that what all positive steps Pakistan has taken in the last 8 years, they get overshadowed when anybody looks at the AQ Khan affair.
But that's not everyone's view. British academic Professor Sean Gregory heads the Pakistan Security Research Unit at Bradford University.
Many people have taken the AQ Khan story as a sort of end point, and that is very much what the Pakistan government and military want the international community to believe. The proliferation is at an end. But my view is that it is not at an end, that Pakistan is continuing to proliferate nuclear and nuclear-related technologies, and that AQ Khan never was working alone.
Gregory's concern is that Pakistan is providing technology to other states. But in Washington, the real worry focuses on a different scenario, the weapons falling into the hands of extremists within the country. Could this really happen? Bruce Riddell, formerly of the CIA.
I think the plausible scenario is one in which some elements of the Pakistani military have been infiltrated by extremist Islamic forces, probably connected with al-Qaeda, and steal one or two bombs, just take them off the shelf, for al-Qaeda to use somewhere in the world. We know that al-Qaeda has made this a top priority. We know that they've been trying for a long time to penetrate into the Pakistani security establishment. So I think there is reason to worry about the scenario of a stolen bomb or two.
I think that's not a likely scenario at all.
Mark Fitzpatrick.
Pakistan's nuclear weapons, not only are they well guarded, but they're separated. The weapons are separated from the missiles. The nuclear core, the fissile material, is separated from the rest of the weapon. So terrorists would have to seize both parts of that, and then they'd have to have the knowledge to put it together, and then the knowledge to fire it. And it's very difficult sequencing. So much more plausible is that it would be an insider plot. Now, that insider plot itself is not very plausible because of the controls that Pakistan has put in place.
Pakistan has taken steps to improve security. For instance, creating a strategic forces command to physically protect the weapons. But how advanced the actual protection is remains unclear. For instance, does Pakistan have electronic locking devices called permissive action links on its weapons? Professor Sean Gregory isn't sure.
These are like a kind of chip and pin system where unless you've got the right sort of card and you type in the right code, the weapon itself is actually unusable. And the Americans developed this system in the 1960s. Now, obviously, that technology would be extremely useful in securing Pakistan's nuclear weapons against the possibility that they fell into terrorist hands. The big problem is that the Americans weren't able to give Pakistan this technology because of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's a very important question whether Pakistan does or does not have PALs.
The details of security systems are inevitably highly sensitive, but Brigadier General Naeem Salik says Pakistan has developed its own locking system.
Pakistan has developed its own PAL systems, which obviously ensure that even if somebody, unauthorized person, gets hold of a weapon, he cannot activate it unless he also has access to the electronic codes. So that is one thing. Second is that that usual practice which is there in all nuclear weapon states, that is the two-man rule. There is a need for authentication at every level and authentication by a second person. So those kind of security mechanisms are inbuilt.
These measures mean fears have focused not so much on a break-in and the stealing of a bomb, but on the insider threat. America is not permitted to provide direct technological help because Pakistan is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But America has provided millions of dollars of financial assistance and advice, including help in instituting a personnel reliability program to vet staff and ensure they don't go rogue. Similar programs in other nuclear states result in significant numbers of employees being found unsuitable for work on nuclear weapons. Sean Gregory.
Comparative analysis that I've seen of, for example, the American situation, where they also have a personnel reliability program, which essentially is the one that the Pakistanis copied, that shows that something like 4 or 5% of people annually are decertified from nuclear weapons duties for various reasons. This might be, you know, drug problem, it might be deviancy of some kind, it might be simply anti-government sympathies, whatever. Now, that figure of 4 or 5% seems pretty consistent across the other nuclear weapon states that I have looked at over the years. So it's reasonable to say that something like 1 in 20 to 1 in 25 of those with nuclear weapons duties in Pakistan may be, in some senses, a threat to those weapons.
Those working on Pakistan's nuclear weapons are now being watched. Are their religious views being watched too? Naeem Salik.
Definitely, because you like people who are normal, who are moderate people. Being religious in Pakistani society, you know, is not considered to be a bad thing. But somebody having extremist religious views obviously causes concern and is definitely watched. That issue is taken very seriously.
Access to the weapons and knowledge about the program is highly restricted. If someone wanted to get to the weapons, could they find them?
The information is disseminated on need-to-know basis. I was there for 7 years. People sitting in the offices on the right and left of my office, I didn't have any clue as to what they were doing. So I would only get the information which was required to perform my duties. There have been a lot of speculation, people talking about weapons being distributed at 6 locations and this place and that place. No one knows. Frankly speaking, if you want my candid answer, I have no clue as to how many locations they are, where they are located.
And do the Americans have any idea where the nuclear weapons are? Bruce Riddell.
Absolutely not. The Pakistanis have taken our advice on how to best build a apparatus to protect the weapons, but they have not provided information about where the various pieces are. Fundamental reason, they don't trust us. They suspect that if we were told where all their weapons and devices are, we would pass that information to the Indians or to the Israelis or use it ourselves. Pakistanis do not have a great deal of faith in the United States as a reliable ally. They're not going to tell us where the country's crown jewels are being hidden.
But some independent experts, like Sean Gregory, say it is possible to work out what general region the weapons are in.
To keep the weapons sites away from the Indo-Pakistan border, and obviously therefore the danger that Indian tanks could roll across the border and occupy these sites, they moved a lot of their nuclear weapons infrastructure to the north and the west of the country. And that, of course, is right in the area where the militants and the extremists are strongest. And so there is a direct physical threat. That threat is real.
Campaigning is currently underway for Pakistan's elections, due on February the 18th. But will Pakistan emerge stable, or could there be another coup? And if there was, what would happen to the weapons? Retired Brigadier General Naeem Salik.
Last time around, the military coup took place in 99, and General Musharraf took over. But he had control over the nuclear weapons by virtue of being the head of the state, being president, not in his capacity as the army chief.
The head of state, whoever that might be, has his finger on the button, but shares that responsibility with a national command authority composed of senior civilian and military figures. But the fear remains that the current unstable political situation could lead to chaos. If there were an extremist coup, or if the state were to collapse, what could America actually do to prevent the nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands? Some say America must be prepared. Mike O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution wrote a widely discussed article in the New York Times looking at the military options.
Pakistan is too big and too far for any kind of a ground force to go in and just secure a large part of the country. It's six times the size of Iraq by population, and that implies six times the required force levels to stabilize the country. And even if you're talking about one major province, it would still be several hundred thousand troops, and it would take us several months to get there. So it would only make any sense at all in the context of gradual decay of the country, together with the remaining core element of the security forces and government asking for our help.
But Pakistan is unlikely to ask for help. It recently rejected the idea of American troops coming into the country to fight al-Qaeda, and so it's hard to imagine them asking for help in protecting the country's most prized assets. So what options do the Americans have? Bruce Riddell.
I don't think there are any good options. First of all, if a couple of weapons, or even just one, were stolen out of Pakistan's inventory by extremists, we might not even know about it until it's too late. I think the odds are that if they were able to successfully infiltrate the Pakistani security apparatus and take one of those weapons, we're not going to know anything about it until it's actually the mushroom cloud has exploded.
Nuclear weapons are often referred to as the crown jewels by Pakistanis. Amidst all the chaos of recent decades, they are the one symbol of what the country can achieve. And protecting the weapons is one of the few issues that an often deeply divided country can unite around. Pakistani leaders don't like scepticism surrounding safety of their nuclear weapons. The country's media reflects the distaste felt in Pakistan about the constant questioning of how safe the weapons are.
You have just joined us in the 97th edition of Worldview from Islamabad, coming to you from the headquarters of PTV News, right here in the Pakistani capital. Now, could it be really possible that we in Pakistan built a nuclear bomb but are now confused and don't know how to protect it, how to safeguard it from falling into the wrong hands?
Many in Pakistan believe the US has never been comfortable with the country having nuclear weapons. One editorial from last week argued that the real issue was not to protect Pakistan's weapons from extremists, but from the evil designs of the US, who were planning operations to remove them. a possible reference to Michael O'Hanlon's article in the New York Times.
The very fact that we're thinking out loud like this on the pages of the New York Times to them suggests that we are more worried about their security than they want us to be, that we're more worried about these weapons than they think we need to be, and they would see even the op-ed writing itself as bordering on an infringement of their sovereignty. At least this is the kind of tone in response that I've heard from a number of Pakistani colleagues.
The heated debate perhaps tells us as much about the complex relationship between the US and Pakistan as it does about nuclear security. Both countries are allies but remain deeply suspicious of each other. Washington fears Pakistan's instability, but knows that it also needs its help in fighting terrorism. And Pakistan remains suspicious of America's real long-term motives, resenting what it sees as alarmist talk. When I asked President Musharraf for his views for this BBC World Service programme, he was dismissive of the idea of any risk to the weapons.
I feel the only way that these could be endangered are two. I can't see anything else. Number one, that this Al-Qaeda or terrorist or whatever militant Taliban gets so strong that they defeat the Pakistan army. And number two, that they politically get so strong that they win in these elections. I think the possibility of any one of them is zero, multiplied by zero and divided by zero.
I hope that's true. But I think what we have to bear in mind is that Al-Qaeda has proven itself to be a resourceful and relentless enemy. It has made this one of its top priorities. And what we're seeing in Pakistan in the last couple of years is a growth in the size of the Al-Qaeda organization within that country. I hope it's alarmist. I hope it's something we don't need to worry about. But frankly, that doesn't give me a lot of reassurance.
Bruce Riddell. There does seem to be a general consensus that Pakistan's weapons are unlikely to fall into the wrong hands. But for many countries, and especially the United States, even the smallest chance is enough to create deep anxiety, an anxiety which feeds back into mistrust and suspicion.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.